Okay, call the House Hess Committee meeting together. And this is 10 minutes after 3 on April 12th. And let the record show that members present are Representative Seaton, Representative Gardner, Representative Sisna, and myself, Wilson. And my committee staff today are my Hess Committee aide, Kathy Hope Erickson, our secretary, Ellen Nodder, and our LIO moderator, Justin Hayes. Thank you for being with us today. Our agenda today is we're going to hear three bills, House Bill 231, House Bill 161, and House Bill 204. We had scheduled House Bill 29, however, that was pending referral, and we haven't received it yet. And we will not be hearing House Bill 112 because that has been pulled from the committee indefinitely by the sponsor. So,
which one?
House Bill 112. That was the Child Protection Interview Transport, and so that is going to be off our agenda until further notice. So we'll start out with and Representative Corn is in a transportation meeting, and McGuire is in a another meeting. I'm not sure which one that is. Alrighty, I will be hearing public testimony on the other three bills. And behind tab 2 of our three ring is our House Bill 231, Human Services Grants Eligibility. That is a bill of my own, and so I'll turn the gavel over to Representative Seaton while we go through that bill. So Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you like to present 231?
Okay, thank you. House Bill 231 is a Human Services Matching Grant Program, and we have programs across the state now that are actually the only communities that currently receive them are Anchorage, Fairbanks, and just lately Mat-Su qualified because of the population, and the population was 65,000 people. And so what we're trying to do is see if there's other areas of the state that can qualify for these grants, but because there's no other areas of the state with that big of a population, what I was proposing to do in this bill would be to extend the definition of a qualified municipality to include a consortium of municipalities located in the same geographic area and with a population that exceeds 50,000. And in the last committee, that was amended. Now it's down to 35,000. And I will talk about that point a little bit later. But anyway, these grants, in order to qualify for the grants, the municipality has to provide 30% of the funding, comply with the grant application process, and to establish a citizens advisory group to help establish the priorities in the area and to see who gets the grants. So there's got to be an umbrella type group that makes the decisions of where the grants go and who they go to. So in Southeast Alaska, which I'm proposing, the reason I'm proposing this, because it would allow Southeast Alaska to qualify for these grants if they were under the umbrella of someone else, and we're looking at Southeast Conference to be our umbrella. Southeast Conference works real close with all of our communities presently, and also we have Catholic Social Services reaches out and doesn't just take care of their participants in Juneau, even though they're located in Juneau. They reach out into many of the communities in Southeast, and so does the United Way. So this would be a way for us to be able to qualify for the grants and to be able to, in times when the communities aren't receiving revenue sharing anymore, expenses are going up, it's really a lot harder for them to take care of human services within the communities. And this is one way, another avenue, that they could, with the help of pulling together, still coming up with the 30% funds, their matching funds for the grants. So in Southeast, there are several other areas that work, like Senators of Community, United Way, Alaska's Health Fair, Southeast Alaska Food Bank, Community Catholic Community Services, AWARE, Alaska Legal Services, and Southeast Senior Services. So I really think this is a fairness issue, and there has been a slight shift in the legislature just this year. We opened up, in one instance, we opened up the availability of grants so that there were some utilities that were private utilities that couldn't get the grants, and now we've opened that up. And so that the precedent has been set that this is something that we're, that evidently the legislative body has decided to do. So with that, if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Matt. Representative Wilson. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Is there anyone who's opposed to this?
Not that I know of. I haven't heard, no one has stepped up and made any comments to the negative.
Makes sense to me.
And
For the record, Representative McGuire joined us at 3:15. Is there any other questions for the sponsor? I guess Representative Wilson, is your intention to have the committee, we have two versions for us. Is your intention to have version G, the CS for House Bill 231, adopted? We haven't had a motion for a bill yet.
You know, maybe we should talk about that a little bit, because I would really rather have the original bill before us than the committee substitute from the last committee. And the reason is because I do know that there is some reluctance, because typically Anchorage and Fairbanks have had that money to themselves, and now Matt Sue has now joined them. And I think it would be probably, they would like to see that communities work together to try to get this, rather than getting it down narrowed so that we can have a whole bunch of people qualify. I think they would like to see communities that will reach out to each other and pull together so that you can get more bang for the buck, you might say. So I guess I'll leave that up to the committee to decide, but I think the chances of the bill going through are probably better with the original bill.
And Representative Wilson, is the only difference in the two pieces of legislation $35,000 or $50,000?
That's the only difference.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sisna?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I was on the committee, the first committee of referral, and I know the conversation at that time was that there was one representative from one of the areas north and of in the northern part of the state, and that's kind of one of those things that right here we're really representing Southeast and South Central Alaska, and there was a little broader membership in that committee, and that person felt that it was hard to get up to the 50,000. Is it 50,000?
Yeah,
it's 50,000. And that and I know Representative Wilson, you are thinking of the model of the Southeast Conference, and I think also that hey, what?
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Through the chair. Actually, that's left up in the air in the bill, so that if communities want to pull together to do this, they can. And geographic area is not defined in the bill, because mm-hmm. we want it to be able to have communities to be able to do this if they choose. That's going to mean working together, mm-hmm. and that's not always such a bad thing.
No. And yeah. And I guess my, the sort of just to throw this out as conversation while we're deciding which whether the CS or the regular House bill on this, the concern that I heard was that if you're talking some of these northern communities, to get up to the 50,000, it's a lot of communities to get together. And that they're going to have to get a group of communities together, even at 35, in order to qualify. But that's worth thinking about.
Yeah. Let's just pull the bill up. I mean, let's just do the
Okay, Representative Wilson, then your motion is to have the CS for 231 version G from CRA before the committee. Okay, thank you. Do we have any other questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, we have several people to testify. We have Rosemary Evelyn from Juno, are you? Oh, you're here with us. Great. Rosemary.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rosemary Hagevig. I have, I'm here today speaking for Southeast Conference. I've been on the board of directors at Southeast Conference probably for close to 10 years, and so I'm pretty intimately familiar with the structures there. For the record, I also am an executive director of a regional social services organization that could potentially benefit from this, so I need to be real clear with that. I'd like to thank Representative Wilson for making this opportunity available to us and to share with you that Southeast Conference and the many regional social services providers in Southeast Alaska support this piece of legislation. We more than meet the threshold for population. I believe the last census data shows the total population in Southeast Alaska just a little bit over 70,000. We have experienced in the region, as you know, some serious setbacks with respect to the growth of our economy, and many of the local governments, as much as they would like to be supporting social services, the social services infrastructure in the region, are having a more and more difficult time coming up with specific grant amounts for their in their local budgets. This would give us an opportunity to infuse some additional additional level of resources into the community, and I think certainly from my own personal experience and what I know to be in place already, we more than would be able to meet the required 30% match. There was some discussion in the last committee of referral about the fiscal note, and in our conversations with the department, they shed some light on why that truly would be a zero fiscal note, even though they did provide some scenarios about eventual costs. But for this year, because it's the kind of a program where people don't even apply to participate in it until the 1st of October, we really would be talking about a fiscal year seven fiscal implication there. So the other thing that we would like to make very clear is that we are not interested in seeing anything happen that would not hold harmless our neighbors to the north. Certainly what is going on in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and now in Mat-Su is of critical importance. We just would like to share in the opportunity to be able to participate in the same kind of a program. So as I said, just in closing, there are a number of organizations under the United Way umbrella in Southeast Alaska that provide region-wide services, and between the Southeast Conference Board and the United Way Board, we would have no difficulty at all in putting together the required kind of fiscal oversight that would be necessary. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Does anyone question? Anyone on the committee have any questions for Rosemary this time? Thank you, Rosemary.
Thank you very much.
Testimony. Let's go to Rolo Poole. Sorry, it's not four. Janet Clark. Hi, Janet.
Hi, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Janet Clark with the Department of Health and Social Services. I'm here today to discuss the fiscal note, maybe walk through the committee on any questions you might have. So I guess we'll start with that. Mr. Chairman, the fiscal note that we prepared for the CS from the CNRA version basically is a zero fiscal note because the legislation does not require an appropriation because the program is based on pro rata proportion of population. It does not in and of itself require an increased appropriation. So, for example, if it's the appropriation is $1 million, however many grantees or municipalities qualify, then that amount would just be prorated. That's the first point that I'd like to make. The second point is that, as Ms. Hegevig said, based on the other part of the statute, if this bill were to pass, it would not affect the municipalities who've already applied for the program October 1st, 2004. The legislation requires that municipalities apply before October 1st of the preceding fiscal year. So for FY06, the grantees who would qualify would be Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Mat-Su. However, it would have profound impact on FY07 if the legislation were to pass. What we provided to the committee were two scenarios based on the change to $35,000. The first scenario basically assumes the legislation would pass. It assumes that regional consortiums would basically form for all regions of the state. At the 35,000 population level, we basically looked at census areas and regional configurations and assumed that all the regions would get together and actually qualify. And also, the first scenario would presume that there'd be no additional money for this program appropriated by the legislature. If that were to occur, then Anchorage, Mat-Su, and Fairbanks would see significant reductions in their shares of the appropriated funds, and other communities would see a corresponding increase. So that's the first scenario. The second scenario we did, which is on page 4 of the fiscal note, basically is the same assumptions as I outlined in the first scenario, except that we then presume that the legislature would appropriate additional funds to hold all communities harmless and still provide grants for all the other communities. And based on that scenario, it would cost an additional $613,483 to hold everybody harmless under that scenario. So we provided this information to give the legislature some information, knowing that the future may require either an increased appropriation decision or there might be some decision about reduced funds for the existing grantees.
Thank you, Jen. And I had a question. From DHSS point of view, what is the current reason for the discrimination between these areas? I mean, it seems like if we're allowing these grants for social service agencies throughout the state, why is it that only these certain size population areas are given those grants and they are not extended to other areas that may have the same kind of programs and be able to come up with a local match?
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I can do is give you some history of the program, which might give you some information about where it started. The program was actually put into statute in 1992 by then Representative Boyer. Prior to that, there were block grants provided to Anchorage and Fairbanks. And the block grants actually started in the early 80s when there, frankly, was a lot of money. The idea at the time was that Fairbanks and Anchorage were disproportionately affected by social services programs because they were such large hub communities. People came to those communities for services, and the view was that the state ought to offset some of those costs that the local communities were absorbing. At the same time, frankly, there was a lot more money available for designated grants for other communities throughout the state that, frankly, we don't have anymore, at least in our department, and I don't think in any other department. So the history was such that it started with Anchorage and Fairbanks qualifying, and the statute was basically written so that Anchorage and Fairbanks would qualify in 1992. So what's changed is now with the population increase in the Mat-Su borough, again, 2 years ago, Mat-Su qualified, started, they applied 2 years ago in October. FY05 is the first year they've received a grant. So the whole dynamics, I think, have changed from what the original social services block grant and the original funding for the program has definitely changed with Mat-Su now qualifying.
Okay, and Janet, was that also, was there a balance in the original, like, I mean, were there, like happens in bonding issues where you do, where there's a number of grants to individual municipalities, smaller ones or individual communities, and then block grants to the larger municipalities to kind of set up their own structure in there, or I'm just trying to figure out if there was any, or if it was just simply a grant to the two large communities.
Mr. Chairman, I think that there were some other designated grants, again, to other local communities that are not designated in the budget anymore. There also were, I would say, not necessarily competitive grants, but more opportunity for other local municipalities to get social services funding.
Okay, thank you. And does anyone else on the committee have a question for Ms. Clark? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Janet, if I hear you right, what I'm hearing is that everybody was getting some kind of extra help as funds in all the areas, but slowly as the money tightened up, they discontinued the help in the smaller areas, but Anchorage and Fairbanks continued with theirs.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct. I would have to say that the social services block grants at one point, I believe they were up to $4 million. I mean, they were quite large grants and have been ratcheted back to the level they are now. So certainly the block grants themselves have been reduced as well.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? See no further questions. Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Clark. And we have Molly Colum, I believe it is, from Anchorage. Are you online?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, would you like to testify? Would you give your affiliation and go ahead?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Molly Cullum, Grant Administrator for the Municipality of Anchorage, Department of Health and Human Services. I'm speaking today on behalf of Heather Wheeler, Deputy Director of the Anchorage Department of Health and Human Services, as she could not be present for this hearing. The Anchorage Department of Health and Human Services supports House Bill 231, and the effort to expand human service matching grant programs to benefit more Alaska communities. However, with that expansion, we would hope the legislature would ensure sufficient funding to hold current recipients harmless. Passing this legislation with sufficient funding will allow more communities to provide the essential safety net services to prevent or alleviate serious physical or mental hardship in this state, while not diminishing services in current recipient communities. Through grants to local nonprofit agencies, the Human Services Matching Grant supports basic services that are critical to our state's most vulnerable citizens, children, abuse victims, those in temporary crisis or homelessness, and senior citizens. According to Janet Clark's comments, Human Service Matching Grant funding was originally made available to larger Alaska communities in the 1980s in an effort to offset the disproportionate demand coming from people all over the state. The municipality continues to serve the state as a hub community, drawing and attracting people for services from around the state to Anchorage. Because Anchorage serves so many people from outside its borders, it is in this state's best overall interest for the legislature not to decrease funding for Anchorage in order to make room for more communities. Currently, 65% of Anchorage's human service matching grant funding goes for food and shelter programs. These services are associated with people on the move, people in crisis, and people in transition to and from rural communities. The municipality of Anchorage believes in being a responsible citizen of the state of Alaska, and as such has never closed its doors to people from outside of Anchorage who seek services. Because of this, if more communities become eligible for human service dollars, we ask that sufficient funding be provided to sustain current services. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Molly, and I'm sure you can understand that the community or this committee will probably be looking at that support. However, that'll be a year or so in the future because we're not talking about our current budget. It sounded like you had written testimony, and if you could send that in, that would be appreciated so it can follow the bill. Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Cole? Yes, Representative Wilson.
I actually don't have a question for her, but I do have a question for Janet.
Well, yeah,
did she leave? No,
she's back here. We can bring her up in just. Yeah. Does anyone else have a question for Ms. Cullum? Thank you very much for your testimony, and if you could send that in, that would be good. And the fax number here is 465-3175 if you have written testimony. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here in the audience to testify on House Bill 231? Janet, could you come back up? And Representative Wilson had a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have no, my intentions for this bill would definitely not to make things worse for any other area of the state. I mean, I wouldn't want that to happen either. And so, Janet, what I'd like to ask you is if in October you got two applications, and when you submit your budget to the governor next year, would you put an increase there then in that area, in that part, so that there would be, I just want to make sure that where you're coming from and we're on the same level here of thinking, and would you put that that increase automatically into the budget as you submit your budget to the governor?
Again, Janet Clark for the record with the Department of Health and Social Services. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, based on whoever applies before October 1st, we would certainly prepare the request to the governor so that he would be aware of what the implications would be if that was not funded. And again, that information would be available to the legislature as well.
Thank you, Janet. Yes. And one thing I would like to say I wanted to tell Ms. Cullum there that one of the things is that if all the social services or the grants are going through the main communities, what that does is tends to, if those services aren't provided in the outlying communities at all, then that tends to bring the people that need those services to the hub communities, and so you concentrate those services in those communities. So I think that the purpose of this bill is to allow some distribution so that we can keep people in the communities where they reside. So without anyone else to testify, we'll close the public hearing. And with that, I'll turn the gavel back over to the... Oh, okay. You want me to continue? Is there any discussion on the bill? Representative Gardner. Or is there any discussion? No. Representative Gardner, do you have a motion?
Sure. I move House Bill 231, identified as 24-LSO791/G, with accompanying fiscal notes. I don't think we have recommendations or amendments.
There were no amendments,
right.
And so is there any objection to moving CS for 231 from committee? Version G, seeing none. 231 will pass from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. And I'll turn the gavel back over to Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Okay, that's good. We're on to the next bill. Behind tab 3 in your three-ring binder is House Bill 161, Reemployment of Retirees, with it's a bill of Representative Jim Elkins, and his Chief of Staff, Jim Van Horn, will present the bill. So, Jim, if you can tell us about the bill. And I think a lot of us have heard a lot about the bill, but yes, let us bring us up to date where it's at right now.
Yes, Madam Chairman, Representative Elkins is the co-chair of Transportation. They got delayed because of the floor session, so they're in session right now. For the record, my name is Jim Van Horn. I'm working the staff of Representative Jim Elkins, the sponsor of this bill. Madam Chairman, before you today is House Bill 161, which extends the sunset date for legislation enacted by House Bill 242 in 2001 and Senate Bill 94 in 2003. This legislation allows the rehire of certain PERS and TERS members who retired with a normal retirement. These rehires can continue to receive normal retirement benefits if they waive further participation in the retirement systems. During their period of reemployment, no contributions to the PERS and TERS systems are required from the employee or the employer. This legislation is scheduled to sunset on July the 1st, 2005. Included in the committee packet is a copy of an Alaska legislative report entitled Results of the Retiree Return Program from the Division of Retirement and Benefits. It's dated February the 10th, 2005. That report shows that as of November 30th, 2004, there were a total of 211 retirees rehired under PERS and 124 retirees under the TERS program for a total of 335 employees statewide. This equates to 0.1% of all PERS and TERS participants statewide. I call your attention to page 4 of the report. On September 14, 2004, the Attorney General issued an opinion stating that once the current legislation sunsets on July 1, 2005, reemployed retirees can no longer receive retirement benefits when employed by a PERS or TERS employer. If they do continue employment, they must begin making contributions to the retirement systems and have their retirement benefits stopped. Madam Chairman, this came as a complete surprise to many. The general opinion was that after the initial period, the legislature would review the program to see whether or not it was successful and decide if it should be continued. Life decisions were made based on this opinion, and now it'll be slammed shut in their faces. It should be noted that the original legislation was a component of a workforce development initiative that the state and a number of employers undertook to address workforce shortages that were already being experienced. Also in the packet is an article from the February issue of State News, which is published by the Council of State Governments. The article entitled State Worker Shortage Looms shows that Alaska is not alone. Many other states will be and are now facing the effects of approaching retirement implosion as the baby boomers move into their golden years. A 2002 study showed that 30% of many states' workforce would be retirement eligible by 2006. Compounding an approaching worker shortage, the Rockefeller Institute of Government study confirms that nationally, 50% of government jobs are in occupation requiring specialized training, education, or job skills, compared to just 29% in the private sector. It is very obvious that the problem of workforce shortages will not go away, but will only intensify with time. At a hearing on this bill, the House Special Committee on Education introduced and moved committee substitute for House Bill 161 that clearly states that the legislature understands that the rehire of retirees is a valuable tool for school districts and public employers to manage workforce shortages. At the same time, the CS finds that human resource managers must plan to meet their future workforce needs without reliance on retired workers. I call your attention to pages 13 and 24 of this legislative report on the retiree rehire program. The pie charts for both the PERS and TERS programs clearly show two things. The majority of the retirees who have been rehired were retired over 24 months before coming back to work, and the percentage of rehires has slowly decreased since 2002. I also call your attention to the closed fiscal note. Its attachment was a zero fiscal note. Madam Chairman, the current legislation has provided human resource managers with an excellent tool to retain workers for hard-to-fill positions, and we urge extension of this, we urge passage of this extension. Thank you very much. I'm open for questions.
Okay, Representative McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been a long time since I've had a bill that literally makes me shake, and this bill does. And I don't have any questions because I've already researched the answers to my questions myself, and I'm going to have to leave here in a few minutes for bills up in finance, but I just want to state on the record, this is one of the most embarrassing, in my opinion, pieces of legislation and embarrassing problems that we have created. And I see members in the public here, maybe this is their first time to Juneau. Maybe they don't get an opportunity to put a focus on some of the work that we do down here. But I'm embarrassed that I was in the legislature at the time that this bill passed. And I remember the questions that I asked on the floor and in committees. I remember the debate that took place. I remember the statements that were made. This bill was intended for very narrow circumstances. In small communities in rural Alaska where there was a teacher shortage, where kids were being left behind, if you will, because there weren't adequate teachers there. And the statement was made at that time by a very good friend of mine over in the other body, Senator Stevens, Gary Stevens, that this would be an opportunity to bring some of these people back into the workforce and help benefit kids. There were also statements made about the need for public health workers in some of these communities where there was a shortage. And I signed off on those very narrow circumstances with the agreement and understanding that this program would sunset and that we would take a look at how it had been used as a tool in the tool belt. And now has come that time. And we are taking a look, and the amount of information that I have on the abuse of this program is staggering. And it's by this administration, and it's by the former administration. There is testimony I received even this as recent as last week from some of the young men in our state that have made the commitment to serve as police officers. And it's a huge commitment. And they're telling me stories of people that are leaving to go to Hawaii for 30 days without even cleaning out their desk, knowing full well that when they come back, they'll be given a paycheck month to month, not have to pay into PERS. It's not only an abuse, but it serves as a tremendous disincentive to these people who have made the commitment of public service and are at that point expecting to be in line and to compete for those opportunities to rise up the ranks. I don't even think we will begin to see the full effects of what's happened over the last 5 years for decades to come. And I cannot in good conscience support this extension. I think the best thing to all of us that could happen is that this program sunsets in July, and those individuals that have taken advantage of the program will get an opportunity to decide whether or not the job that they've taken is really worth it or not. And I hope that it sends a very strong message to many of those young men and women in our state and middle-aged men and women in our state who have tried, who have applied for some of these positions and who frankly have been simply denied them in favor of somebody who might have political curry with somebody else. And I just think particularly now when our PERS and TERS system is in the shape that it's in, I think it's devastating. And the final thing I want to put on the record, I have heard all kinds of threats from this administration that we'll be sued and you've got to help us out of this bind and so on. And I am here to tell you, I have looked over the waiver. I have looked over and recall the debate that we had on the floor. There is no possible way that a state employee could have reasonably relied upon anything other than the waiver that they signed, which clearly stated that this sunset would occur in July. And so Somebody said to me, well, Personnel Board made these other statements. And, you know, I've got news for you. In the Judiciary Committee, we have all kinds of letters that are drummed up from personnel in various departments from time to time that say things that aren't true, that say things they believed were true probably, but aren't true. I had an example with the Department of Labor last week where companies were relying upon a Department of Labor opinion that directly contradicted what's in the law, in the statute books. And the fact of the matter is, that's the law. And so the law is that this program sunsets, and that's what I want to see happen. And I'm terribly embarrassed to have been a part of it. I think when the public starts to find out about what has happened, the abuse by this administration and the prior, I think they're going to be devastated.
Any other comments by the committee members? Representative Seaton?
Yeah, I wanted to get clear understanding. There's been some real confusion. I just happened to have been at a previous committee where this was talked about, and there was the assumption that everybody was going to have to leave government service if this sunset, all the people that had these waivers. And I just wanted to get it clearly on the record that all those people are in a job and this waiver goes away so that they can continue to get retirement and that and a paycheck, but that they can still continue employment. They're just back into the retirement system. They get their regular pay. They're paying in and accumulating more service, more retirement time and service. And so that's a decision they make, and that if we reject this bill, we are not saying that we're terminating all those employees.
No, and I think some of them have come back and have not opted out of the PERS or TERS program. The TERS program has some very stringent sideboards on it, whereas the PERS doesn't. But this CS for this Education Committee came up with directs the legislature to do just that. I do know of a couple cases where people have come back either part-time or at a lower pay scale. But by and far, I think the majority of the people, you're correct, they're just turned right around again and their old position back. And I agree there's probably been some abuses. But there is there'd be a heavy impact on some of the programs of the state. The United Fishermen of Alaska, UFA, are strongly behind this bill because we're going to lose about 30-some fish biologists. There was a big exodus of these people when the feds came in on the subsistence program. They retired from the state and jumped over to the feds. That left a big hole. A lot of people came back. But it's up to the committee. It's just presenting the facts as we see them. And this is a companion bill to one in the Senate.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question would be, I haven't been on any of the committees that have been looking at the PERS-TERS situation, but what the reported discussion has been is that system is in real trouble, and it seems sort of inconsistent to at one time be talking about how to fix that program that may, if in fact it's in trouble, that it won't work for anyone. At the same time that we're talking about continuing with something that would only make it harder for the program to exist because it's the continual paying into that program that gives it the strength that allows it to continue, I would assume.
Through the chair to Representative Sisna. If you read the fiscal note, there's zero fiscal impact on this. In fact, I think total cost, I don't know where they come with this figure, $106.53.
But nonetheless, to the PERS-TERS situation, and I don't know if the fiscal note really talks to the PERS-TERS situation.
This is the impact on the PERS-TERS.
It's hard for me to imagine that.
The employer is not paying into it also. The employee and the employer. And also, some of your retirees are already under Alaska care. So they're not paying medical, but that's that's what it came up with, is zero.
Seems strange, I believe.
Yeah, I give it back to you.
Representative Seaton, since you've been working on the PERS and TERS bill in your committee quite extensively, will you kind of expound upon that just a little bit?
Well, the situation is such that if there was no problem with PERS and TERS, so that we were collecting under the normal cost rate all of the money that would be necessary for a person's retirement, then whether you had fewer employees or more employees has no effect. However, we have this $15 billion of past service cost liability, payments that we're going to have to make in the future. And so what has happened in the past use of this bill is that the employers are not paying in on towards a past service cost. That past service cost is escalating at 5%, or the contribution rate is escalating at 5% a year. So in just a few years, we're going to be paying like 44% for the teachers for the past service cost. And the question is, and I haven't looked at the new CS on this bill, as whether this bill is now going to make the employers use their entire wage base, including these waivered employees. And if they make that contribution for these waivered employees, in other words, if they would be paying into the system, then it wouldn't have the effect. If it's as it has been currently, there is a detrimental effect because they're not paying in on the past service cost. So it's that, and I'm not sure where the current CS is, and I'll have to look at that and give implications.
Jim, do you know the answer to that? Have they fixed that from the other committee up to this committee? Have they fixed that part so that
they do state, Madam Chairman, they do state that the I can find it here. It is intended of the legislature that employers that benefit from the provision of the retiree reemployment provision pay an increase in unfunded liability that results to the retirement systems. Now, the charts and the study they did on the report show less than a 1% impact on the system. So it could be as low as on the PERS side, because you have so many employees, as low as $292 a year forever, and the teacher retirement side is $1,065 per year that the employer would pay back into the system for them to rehire a retiree. That's their impact. So on page 11 of the booklet.
While we're waiting, let's pull the CS in front of us and have that one before
Madam
us.
Chair, I'd move that we adopt for discussion CS 163 EDU version G.
Okay, thank you. And let the record show that Representative Corrine has joined us.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I don't have that report.
It's a printout.
It's right there.
Oh, okay. It's
zero. What page was that, Jim? On what page?
Page 11, Madam Chair. There's Mr. Tibbles from the Department of Administration is here, and also I think he wants to testify on this.
Well, let's why don't we have Mr. Tibbles come forward so that he can answer some of these questions for us?
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Tibbles, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration. And I do have some general comments, but I'd be prepared to answer some of the questions that came up first, if you'd like.
Okay, would you please do that?
Regarding the cost, that's definitely a concern that's come up. The concern that you're bringing an individual back that's receiving a benefit but not paying into the system. And I think Representative Seaton got the essence of it. Let me try it just a little bit different. When we hire an individual, we are paying a blended rate, a normal cost rate and a past service rate. The normal cost rate is the amount of the retirement benefit that that individual will receive after putting in a number of years of service, either 30 years or 25 years or reaching retirement eligibility by age. But the benefit that they receive is based on the amount that they and the employer have been paying over their life, over their career. So, for example, if they work 30 years, they're paying, the employer is paying for them into the retirement system. Their pension benefit is based on the amount that's paid. So there is no additional cost to the system for that individual coming back because that individual is not accruing any additional benefits. Now, the part that there is a cost, since we have this unfunded liability, the cost isn't associated with an individual. However, it's associated with the system. There's $5 billion out there. When we take out an individual from the system, that is used, their salary base is used to allocate out the cost of the past service rate, then there becomes a higher rate among their other members. So what the CS that you have in front of you does is it requires all employers at the point, and we talked to our actuary about this, we said, what is the impact of this program? And they calculated a threshold for different for PERS and different for TERS. They calculated a threshold for PERS because at a lower rate because there's higher unfunded status and a smaller pool of individuals. But what they said was at 100 participants of a 242 waiver, there is a $106,000 impact to the system. Now on the PERS system, the impact doesn't trigger until 500 employees. We have 211, so we have a long way to go on the PERS system before they can actually put a dollar amount to the impact. But what the committee substitute that you have in front of you does is it requires all employers, when they bring an individual back, to pay that past service rate at the point that they can put a dollar amount to it, when it no longer becomes negligible. When it hits that point where our actuaries have told us that it is an impact to the system, they will be required to kick into the past service rate. The net effect is an employer brings somebody back on a 242 waiver, they're going to save the normal cost rate. It's going to be a savings to their system. The state of Alaska saved $1 million, certainly not the reason for this program, but we have saved $1 million because of this program. At the same time, going forward, under this bill, the committee subset you have in front of you, we would be required to pay, TERS would be an increase of 0.01%, and at 500 participants on PERS would be 0.02%.
Okay, now Mike, I'm just trying to think how this would put into place. So let's say that you're an employer, you know that you're bringing someone back in that was retired, but you don't have a clue how many there are. So that employer is going to have to go through all the rigmarole of figuring out is he number 99 or is he number 100 or what? Mm-hmm. Why don't we just say that anybody that comes back in that there's a responsibility that so that we don't worry about whether it's 100 members or whether it was 500 members or whether it was 1,000 members, that we just need to decide what the responsibility is. Mm-hmm. Because as we know, with the way it is now, we are absolutely making things worse. And for all the, look at the schools, look at our municipalities, and there's some other entities out there that are on PERS also. I know in my district there's some housing authorities and some other areas that they're on it too. They are absolutely in devastating situations because of this arrears in this whole situation, and they're not getting any extra help to do this, and they're not making any extra money, but they've got this huge extra increase. And I think that we should be responsible at least to make sure that everybody that hires someone, and because we all know that they don't have to pay the health insurance. Well, that's a huge amount per year that they're saving. So an employer should be glad to be at least paying a certain amount. Mm-hmm. Now, where in the bill does it go into where we're deciding that it's going to be a tier situation?
Madam Chair, the part requiring a contribution by employers for the past service would be in Section 3 for TERS and Section 4 for PERS. The administrator of the system would calculate the number of participants, and that would be the director of the Division of Retirement and Benefits. They would monitor the number, and at the point that their actuaries have told them that there's an impact, then a cost will go out to all the employers. That's the way that it's set up. I would be actually where we're working on language, and I would support if you wanted to change that so that it was just an automatic charge. What we could do is charge the past service rate equal to every other employee. And so even when it's negligible, even when the cost is so small that we can't put a dollar amount to it, we could still collect something into the system. That would help. It would be a very small help, but it would help. And I actually have language with me today. We could do that.
You know, this is such a huge problem. And, I know we need it. It's needed in a lot of areas, but I had a chance to look through this, and in some areas, there's one school system even, I was shocked that they had like 30-some people that were all retired people. That's kind of hard to fathom, mm-hmm. but there's no doubt that it's needed in some areas. I know it's needed for our biologists. I know it's needed for some of the the teaching areas where it's hard to find those people, whether they're counselors or math and science or special ed, whatever. I know it's needed, but I think we have a responsibility to make sure that we're covering what we need to cover. Does the rest of the committee understand where I'm going here? maybe if we go online and get some of the rest of the and you just hang on there, because if we go online and get some of the rest of the testimony, you know, I don't know what kind of testimony we're going to have, whether some of this other concerns that we have might be coming up also. So let's go ahead and get our testimony out of the way. Oh, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Sorry. I have a question for the sponsor or for Mr. Van Horn, his representative, and it refers to page 2 at the top, beginning roughly on 9-5, about the intent of the legislature that school districts and public employees, while they're using the tool, need to be developing a work plan for when the employment of the reemployment provisions terminate. Do you know if this language was in the original waiver legislation about having a plan for when the?
Through the chair to you, Representative Garner. I don't know. I don't believe it was. This came out of the Education Committee, and we agree with it for.
I was on the Education Committee, and so I do know that we tried to tighten some of this up to make sure that where the abuses that were taking place wouldn't continue, that they had a plan, that, you know, especially in areas where there was possibility that people could move up in the ranks, so that they wanted to make sure that they were starting to train those people that uh-huh. could move up in the ranks, so that they were perfectly capable of starting to take over some of those higher positions.
Okay. Well, I guess my question is, was the original plan a temporary plan with the intent that the employers have a contingency plan for the end of the waiver program?
Was there a plan on that?
Well, through the chair, you know, again, my understanding, and I think if you were to ask the legislators that were in the room when the vote took place, on the floor and in the committees, they would tell you that this was designed to be a crisis management tool, an interim stopgap measure. It was never designed to be a permanent thing, and that was the sunset, the point of the sunset. And statements that were made on the floor originally, you know, as the sponsors were trying to bring people around, were things like, why don't we look at recruitment? Why don't we look at what we can do to bring people who are currently unemployed into the workforce? Why don't we try to retrain folks that might be in one area to go into another area that we need people more desperately? And again, it's one of those moments. I just look back and I think my gut instinct was right. that the sidebars, you know, just weren't even enough for that, and the abuse took place. And so it's my impression, and ask others that were there, that this was, it was always the intent that these folks would be filling in a crisis and a stopgap, and they should obviously have a plan for after the sunset.
Let's go ahead the answer to your question is those guidelines weren't there. They assumed that people would do that, but they haven't been. So that's kind of where the problem is, I think.
Representative, may I address the sunset issue? Sunset was added in original House Bill 242 in House Finance Committee, and that amendment has been studied pretty thoroughly because it was the basis of the decision from the Department of Law last year. It was used as a critical piece of the Department of Law's opinion that said that the individuals that are currently enrolled in a 242 waiver will, as of July 1, stop receiving their pension benefits. So it's been examined fairly thoroughly. There was no sunset in the original bill. It was added in House Finance Committee when there was some discussion about what the impact to entry-level positions were and how those people were going to be able to move up in career progression. And so Representative Davies at the time offered the amendment and said, we'd like to take a look at it. The discussion wasn't that the program would end, but what they wanted was the committee wanted to reevaluate at that point whether or not individuals that were being brought back were really prohibiting other individuals from being able to move up and progress career-wise. And so I hope that clears up.
So that's fine. Go ahead.
But just to, sorry, Madam Chair, I just have to say on a final point. That, when it came to the floor, the sunset was there. Absolutely. And what I'm saying, no different than we can't all sit on all the committees in the legislature, discussions were taking place in the halls of this building about the concern over this bill and what would be the thing that could get it passed or not. And I'm telling you that without that sunset, I don't believe the bill would have passed. The concern was absolutely there. You mentioned one of them. What would be the morale or the overall impact on those folks rising up the ranks? And then, by the way, were there other things that we could explore? As I said before, recruitment, retraining, other types of things, rather than giving people paychecks after they retire.
Okay, I'm Representative Seaton, and then I'm going to go to the testimony.
Okay, I just had one question on this line, and that was if the concern was on the upward mobility of other employees. Where is that addressed in the report? Not in the legislation, in the report.
Oh.
I mean, the entire sunset provision is to analyze what the effect of the program was on upward mobility of other people within the system, and we've got letters in here indicating there's been a severe detriment to people within the system as not being able to have upward mobility, and where is that addressed in the report here?
Madam Chair, I can tell you that the reporting, there was a section in the original House Bill 242 that required a report to the legislature on the impacts. The section only applied to the TERS system, and in the report that's been provided to you does comply with the requirement that was submitted in the original legislation. Now, we have additional concerns in the administration about how it's been implemented and how it's been implemented in a different way, department by department, and I would like to at some point walk through the administrative order that the governor signed on March 8th that implements the sideboards and talks about what we're going to require the departments to do, the steps that are needed to take place, and the workforce planning that needs to take place before they can bring an individual back on 242. So.
Okay. Let's have the testimony because there's some people online that maybe might not be able to hang in there. So let's go to Fairbanks. John Kern in Fairbanks, are you there, John?
Yes, ma'am. Can you hear me now?
We sure can.
Okay, hi. I have I typed out my testimony. It might run about 6 minutes. I can try to cut it down if there's not enough time.
You know what, John, why don't you hit us with the highlights, and then let me give you our fax. It's 465-3175. That's quite long.
Okay.
But give us as much as you can, you know, just kind
okay.
of
Okay, I'll be happy to.
Okay, thank you.
Anyway, my name is Leo John Karen. I've lived in Alaska since statehood. I received my Bachelor of Science and Master of Science degrees in geology, as well as my Type A teaching credential from the University of Alaska. I lived in Anchorage and Fairbanks and numerous summers living in remote mineral exploration camps and near different rural communities. I taught in a rural community the last 2 years before School District 1, the old state-operated school district, was disbanded. I have some experience as to maybe some solutions to the rural education problem, but I won't go into them here due to a shortage of time. I'd only like to say that I strongly support whatever measures that can be taken to support excellence in education in rural Alaska. I'm not necessarily convinced that the rehire bill is the way to do that. I have some suggestions that I'll fax down, some other alternatives. I am strongly opposed to the extension of the rehire bill for the PERS employees for the following reason. While there are maybe a shortage of qualified teachers willing to work in rural Alaska, there is no shortage of qualified applicants willing to work in town with the state government bureaucracy, court system, university system, or municipal governments. If there was a problem finding qualified applicants, as was recently the case for DOTPF technical engineers, the Department Administration would adjust their internal, quote, internal alignment of salaries for the job class to attract more applicants. If there is a real short-term shortage of experienced personnel for specific jobs, there is and always has been a contracting procedure to gain the needed expertise. Point two, there has been significant abuse of the program as admitted by the administration in bringing forth a corrective administrative order. The order is like the proverbial closing of the barn door after the horses are out, however. And I must note there is no provision to make the order's analysis of need for the flood of recently retired or rehired employees, many of whom never bothered to clean out their desks during the 30-day waiting period. If there is such a brain drain for retiring baby boomers, why was the program only offered to a select few higher-level administrators instead of all retirement-age employees? If it was only a short, it was only a short time ago that we had early retirement legislation. Now a provision is made to let commissioners come back from early retirement without having to make restitution to the PERS system as was required in these retirement incentive program bills. There has been much discussion of the potential for lawsuits from people who believe the misinformation they were given by the Division of Retirements that there would be they would be grandfathered in for life. I would worry more about all the people who could have or did retire or retired early, asserting that they should be given the same opportunity as all the other double dippers in the same job. I don't believe a realistic evaluation has been made of the cost of PERS of inducing Tier 1 employers to retire on time, thereby affecting the retirement program's actuarials. I don't hear any discussion of this when they talk about a zero balance program. I don't see why it's such a hard concept to grasp. It's like when we were students and we wanted to protest the food at the University Commons, the worst thing we could come up with, the worst threat we could have, was that we'd all show up for every meal because, you know, they bid their job on the assumption that 60% wouldn't show up for breakfast or 40% wouldn't show up for lunch. Well, it's the same deal for inducing people to retire early. I think a large part of the actuarials are based on the fact that not everybody retires on time. And this program really induces everybody to retire on time. It's got to have an effect on the program. And you don't hear more from the rank-and-file employees testifying against this legislation, since it's only their bosses who are being given this platinum parachute. There's a real fear of retaliation. I can assure you that self-serving hypocrisy of the supervisors disgusts most employees. It breeds contempt and destroys the spirit of core of the overall workforce. Please accept the fact that, though well-intentioned, this bill needs a sunset. If the need for rural teachers does override the above concerns, please at least make the positions of those in the PERS system who have already been rehired subject to reexaminations pursuant to the safeguards of the recent administrative order. If it can be shown that a true shortage exists for the job in question, the person should be allowed to retain their job while restitution is made to the PERS system, as would take place if the person had taken an early retirement. Any other course of action results in all members of PERS shouldering the cost of these people's 60% bonus. The legislature also needs to be forthright about the transfer of general fund operating costs that have already been transferred to the PERS-TERS system as a result of the existing rehire legislation, and addressing the projected shortfall of future of the PERS-TERS systems. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And make sure you fax that to us, because we want that information. We want. I'm especially interested in you said that you had some other suggestions.
But I actually made the choice when I was working in TERS for 2 years in a small community, and when they did away with the transfer rights and the tenure, it really basically forced you to make a career decision that, you know, you had to either had to assume that in a small community you would be able to fit in with the community for the long term, either that or you basically had to restart your career if something happened. And it was a real incentive. When I was young, I really looked forward to spending my whole life teaching in rural Alaska and being able to transfer to different communities in the state. And then when that went away, I had to look elsewhere for a career path.
Okay, thank you. So you are going to fax that information to us?
Yes, ma'am, I will.
Thank you very much. Let's go on to Robert McCaddy.
Yes, ma'am, that's me. Hello to the committee. I'm Robert McCaddy. I'm a PERS retiree from DOTPF. And I'm just an old retired guy here to kind of protect my PERS, I guess. And I just wanted to congratulate, I don't know if I should do this in this kind of a thing, but I wanted to congratulate Representative Liesl McGuire for exactly speaking my mind. I'm thinking about transferring into her district. I almost decided not to give my testimony, but I'm going to give a very short testimony here that you'll see parallels what she was saying. House Bill 242 originally addressed, for the most part, hard-to-hire teaching slots, especially in the bush. Teacher rehirings have generally been more justified, and I'm giving some positive stuff here first before I go into the PERS stuff. The teacher rehirings have generally been more justified and carefully handled as compared to the mostly supervisory and other, quote, important person rehires in PERS. An assistant principal in this Fairbanks area has told me about her school where, for example, retired teachers who have been rehired are given pink slips at the end of each school year. If a replacement can't be found between school years, then the rehired teacher is taken back again for an additional year, and so on. So my following comments, which will be pretty brief, are really directed more to the PERS, P-E-R-S, rehires, rather than TERS. I think the teacher thing has been generally handled fairly well. Okay. Most of those who have testified for House Bill 61, and I've heard almost all the testimony at these different teleconferences, are either, if they've testified for House Bill 161, are either rehires, going to rehire, or those who represent agencies that do the rehiring. And of course, those who represent rehiring agencies want no constraints on the rehiring practices. And of course, those already rehired or are intending to be rehired are going to be pushing for unrestricted rehiring. Self-interest? Yes, you bet, I think. I know personally of lower-level staff members in several different agencies who are against these rehiring practices but are afraid to give negative testimony. They fear of reprisals from management or senior workers who are rehirees or intend to return as rehirees, sort of the once and future boss syndrome, I think of it as. Obviously, it is the lower level staffer's paycheck that will be diminished when the legislature jacks up the PERS contributions and not for the rehired person. Rehirees collect two fat paychecks while paying nothing into PERS, and the coworkers darn well know it. They know that's going on. They know those people, and they know they're not going to be paying, and they're looking and some of them almost tears in their eyes thinking of more money being taken out of their check. And just one more brief paragraph here. It has been argued that individuals are so knowledgeable and experienced that they or others on the staff cannot be replaced. While I am sure that long-term employees all consider themselves to be irreplaceable, I know I did while I was working, that argument just doesn't wash. Administrators have always had the responsibility of making sure that staff positions can be covered in case of illness, vacations, death, or somebody just quitting. Considering that vacations for long-term employees can extend most of a month, I assume that various organizations don't fall apart during that time. Every employee is replaceable by necessity, except in cases where poor management or favoritism or something like that exists. And I'll stop my testimony there, and thank you very much.
Thank you, and make sure that you fax that in, your testimony in for us, please.
Yes, ma'am.
Let's go to Anchorage, Larry Wiggett. Are you there, Larry?
Yes, Madam Chairman. Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Larry Wiggett, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Anchorage School District. The Anchorage School District supports the legislative intent of HB 161 to rehire retired employees when there is an actual shortage of applicants for the vacant position, and urges the legislature to extend the sunset date for legislation with the caveat that similar restrictions currently placed on the rehire of TERS employees, AS 1421-35, be adopted for PERS employees as well, and perhaps Mr. Tibbles can address the governor's administrative order and how that applies here. We are concerned, as others we have spoken with, that pre-selection and hiring of retirees to fill the job they are vacating without regard as to whether or not there is a qualified applicant pool to draw from eliminates the career ladder and state employment for other employees who are qualified and may apply for a vacant position, and unlike the rehire, would be contributing to the state retirement system. Again, we support the legislative intent of HB 161 to extend the sunset date when there is an actual shortage of applicants for the position, and feel that there should be the same types of restrictions on rehiring PERS employees as there are on TERS employees. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Larry. Is there anyone else online? That's all I have listed here. Anyone else online that wants to testify? Okay, then we'll go. Let's go to the rest of the ones in the room, and then we'll. Bruce Johnson.
For the record, my name is Bruce Johnson, and I'm associated with the Alaska Association of School Boards. Madam Chair, thank you for this opportunity, members of the committee. The ASB membership resolved itself behind the extension of the rehire provision at our annual conference in November in Anchorage. We believe this is a valuable tool for school districts to have. I think it's been used sparingly when necessary, and we still, even with this provision, have positions that are unfilled. At the beginning of every school year, well into the semester in some cases. I was just in a school in the lower Kuskokwim district that wasn't able to hire its second special education teacher till second semester because they just couldn't find someone. So the national shortage of teachers and administrators is very real in Alaska. It's apparently real across the United States as well if you read the news media. And this provides us another tool. We've invested, as Alaskans, a lot of money in teachers who reach an eligibility age for retirement and want to retire, but still might have a couple years left. Maybe they go away and travel a little bit and come back. There are many examples of that. Work just for a couple years and fill some vital needs. I think, as Mr. Wiggett from the Anchorage School District indicated, is that his district is using it judiciously, and I think that most of our districts that we're aware of would just as soon find a young person that they can bring into their employment and guarantee that they're going to be there for a long period of time. It's just not possible in some of the areas of acute shortage today. So we would urge you to consider the extension of this provision that's outlined in the committee substitute for House Bill 161. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Any questions for Bruce? Thank you. Malay Cosgrove? Okay, all right. Chris Christensen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen. I'm the Deputy Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. The retiree return program has been very helpful to the court system, and we are hopeful that it will be extended by the legislature. The court system has approximately 650 non-judicial employees at 32 locations around the state. We currently have only about 10 people who are participating in this program. That doesn't sound like very many, but these are positions that are actually fairly critical to our operation. We have two problems that this program has helped to address. To a much greater extent than the executive branch, we have a number of unique one-person job classes. One example is the state law librarian. When the primary responsibility of a position is unique, there's a very real problem in providing continuity of services. When such a position becomes vacant, there is no one on staff who can cover or pick up the work. Even when the position is not vacant, there's no one on staff who can assist if the incumbent has problems. It's important that the one-person job classes remain filled and that they be filled with knowledgeable persons. We have a very difficult time recruiting internally for these positions. Most of these are unique positions or positions that require specialized education, and more than half of our employees are clerical employees compensated at range 6 to 12, so we cannot really promote these people up for those specific jobs. Madam Chair, the second problem we have is that for certain supervisory positions, we have had no qualified applicants, and we sometimes have had to rehire our supervisors. Now, why is that? We have a lot of turnover in our lower-level positions. Our turnover rate is about 50% before 5 years have passed. We have some rural court locations, such as Kotzebue, where we've had 100% turnover in a year. This is primarily because of low pay. As I said, half of our employees are compensated between range 6 and 12. 75% of our employees are range 15 or below. And people who are compensated at range 8 and 10 simply want to better themselves. You can't blame them for that. They're always looking for something a little more. Turnover, this kind of turnover causes us two problems. It means that, let me also say that we also, for many years, more than a decade now, have been running a mandatory 30-day hiring freeze for every single position. And the only person who's allowed to waive this 30-day hiring freeze is the administrative director. The local judges aren't allowed to waive it. Well, we do this to manage our personal services underfunding. We think it's financially responsible. This means, however, that we have lots of turnover. And when jobs turn over, we have vacancies that last for 30 days. This means that you need to have much more experienced supervisors than you would normally have, because you need people who can keep the caseload moving even when there's lots of vacancy, even when there's lots of new people who need to be trained. But the turnover also means that you have fewer people who get the years of experience they need to become supervisors. So it's sort of a double-edged sword. The retiree return program has enabled the court system to continue to function in an efficient manner because of our ability to hire back experienced and knowledgeable employees in the one-person job classes and in the rare supervisory positions where we simply cannot fill the job. Without it, we would be struggling to fill certain key positions. I would also note that we did participate in the RIP some years ago. The RIP was very, very damaging to our operations, partly because we lost the core of our long-term experienced supervisors. To some extent, this program has helped us make up for that a little bit. And that's one of the reasons we are appreciative of it.
Any questions? Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Okay, having seen none, I'm going to close testimony. It's obvious that to me, it's obvious that there's a need. At the same time, it's obvious that there's some problems that maybe need to be dealt with. I told many people that I would make sure that this bill moved out of committee, but you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to hold this bill just till Thursday so that we can work on some amendments to make sure that the bill is. I would like to pass it on to the next committee, which is State Affairs, but Paul tells me that they're really, really busy in State Affairs and they really don't have time to work on it. And because of that, I'm going to hold it till Thursday. Thursday, at our meeting on Thursday, we do have a trip to the juvenile detention center. That will take about an hour. We will come back here and re-adjourn and take up this bill again. I think this bill is very, very much needed. And you know what? I saw somebody else in the audience that I thought would testify, but I guess they left, so I guess they're not going to. I am concerned about it, and we're going to hold it over. Is there any other comments that Ian would like to make, Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and
I apologize
for being late.
I apologize. Representative Anderson joined us at about
10 minutes ago.
Yeah,
I was very late.
It was about 4:25.
Working on workers' comp, and I appreciate your latitude letting me be gone earlier. The one question I had, and I won't ask Mike because he's been very courteous and in contact with me, and I actually just talked to Jim Duncan and others, so I kind of know where the parties are on the bill, but I had several troopers talk to me from the Public Safety Employees Association, and they're a group that I certainly listen to, as I do state employees and the administration, and they had some concern that they brought up to me several days ago, and I don't recall verbatim what it was, but it was about folks leaving, I think, in management, the higher officers, and then they can't replace, and ultimately they come back, and I don't remember everything, but I'm glad, thank you for holding it, because I want to be able to get a letter or something from them to say what their thoughts are.
I'm not holding it to hold it up.
I know.
Because we do need this bill. I fully recognize that we do. So what I'm asking is everyone that has concerns also that would like to contact my office so that we can work to see if we can, I'll work with Mr. Tibbles, and we will try to make this a better bill and then get it out of here right away on Thursday. So I really ask that the members, after the tour on Thursday, that we make sure we come back here and address this. So thank you very much. Okay, next. Next is House Bill 204, and that's on behind tab 4 of our notebook, Optometrist Use of Pharmaceuticals, and Representative Bill Thomas.
Sam.
Just kidding. Bill, come forward.
Call me up.
Come forward and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I was not going to present my bill because I had my staff was going to do it, but she is sick, so she's sent me here because she's home to present this. And even though I'm very familiar with it because I've lobbied for it for about 5 years, let me start off by first saying that I represent Bill Thomas, and I represent 28 communities. And in those 28 communities, we have one optometrist, no ophthalmologist. So this bill, very critical to the needs of our communities that we have. And we have an unemployment rate, which will be very important as we go on from 85% down to 35%, which is, and in that district we have about, I think, 3,500 fishermen, either fishermen, deckhands related fishermen industry. So they may show up in the unemployment rate, they may not. And the point I'm making is that these probably people, chances of them having insurance are nil. And if anything, they probably end up on the Hess bill that we keep talking about in the building here. So going on from there, it's just, I think that this can have continued costs to the state if we don't address this. So anyway, for optometric physicians, HB 204 changes the current statutes to include oral pharmaceuticals to provide better and more complete eye care to Alaskans. Currently, optometric physicians are limited in the treatment of eye disease that is seen on a routine basis to the use of medications that are applied topically. diseases such as acute allergic reactions, ocular herpes zoster. I don't know what those mean, but you know, I've never had them. So chronic lid diseases and infectious conjunctivitis or something, and lid disease benefit from the help of oral medications. There are 100 optometric physicians in 17 locations that currently serve the Alaska population spanning from Barrow to Juneau. There are 26 other eye care specialists in 6 locations that can prescribe oral pharmaceuticals in the state of Alaska. I'd like to jump in here and point out something that last year while I was campaigning in my district, I ended up with a diverticulitis attack, which is not, you know, is very painful. I was in a village, so I go to the clinic, and they said, well, how do we treat this? And I said, well, you're the physician, and it turns out they're physician assistants. They had to call into another doctor, and I said, I know what it is, because, you know, I'm just about laying over on the side. But they were able to give me a prescription that they told me is probably the most antibiotic, as strong as there were, allowed to be, you know, for this diverticulitis. And I was totally surprised that they have that authority, and yet optometrists cannot give a prescription for a lot of things. So anyway, you know, we talked about this before, but to actually be in a position where a physician assistant was able to give me the medication was definitely, it was good, mind you, because I felt immediately better about a half an hour later. Optometric physicians are often the only eye care physicians available in rural and bush areas in Alaska, throughout Alaska. Their specialties in primary and preventive eye care. Optometric physicians are educated and clinically trained in use of oral therapeutics. This legislation is not adding to the profession, but enabling optometric physicians to practice at the level they are trained. And at this point, I'd like to jump in and remind this body that just 2 weeks ago, we voted on a bill from Representative Stoltz to allow the Asian doctors who have proper documentation come into Alaska to practice medicine because we have a lack of doctors. And now we're here having a bill that's asking to just allow the doctors to use their background, their education to the full extent. And I think it's very important to know that we did vote allowing other doctors who are not trained or educated in our country to come here as long as they pass certain exams. And the benefits of optometric physicians treating ocular-related diseases with oral therapeutics have been demonstrated in 44 other states by legislation. As medicine advances, it becomes more technical and specialized. Without any question, vision is a very important aspect of our lives and should be treated by a trained eye care professional. Currently, optometric physicians must refer outpatients to a general physician, physician assistants, or a nurse practitioner for oral treatment of ocular disease. This legislation removes the extra step by keeping ocular treatment of an eye care professional and saving the patient from undue complications and financial costs and inconvenience. I also like to point out, we also passed a bill just about 2 weeks ago at the same time, which was Representative Meyer's bill, to allow children to give themselves for treatment of anaphylactic shock. Under the optometrist, if they were to come upon you and you're laying there with an anaphylactic shock, under the laws today, cannot treat you. But we allow a student to pack his own syringe in the school and treat himself. And again, I think that, you know, to show a little more consistency with what we're doing, I think that it's good that we move forward and move HB 204. And I, you know, and I've lobbied this in the past, and I'm not a specialist, and I lobbied and worked it for a reason and a purpose, because I think that rural eyes are as important as urban eyes. I think that, you know, I'm glad if I ever have eye problems, I'm in Juneau, because if they happen anywhere else, if in the rural area, you're in trouble. We don't have the doctors there. We do have the physician assistants, but every once in a while, you do have an optometrist that travels southeast, more so than ophthalmologists. I know we do get ophthalmologists in Haines and optometrists because we're close enough and we have a population big enough to support these. But I represent some communities that are down to 600 to 800 people, and I don't think that you will never find the shopping out there for, you know, if they go out there, I'd be surprised. Most of the time, people have to travel here. And just to remind you, for people to come from Cake, if you have a medical problem, to fly here is about $200 round trip. For them to get on the ferry comes through there, I believe it's once every 2 weeks to pick them up, and they have to go to Sitka, to Angoon, to Hoonah, and then get to Juneau. And so they've taken, I think it's another 46 hours to get here or so, and the ferry that they stop in to Cake doesn't come straight to Juneau. It goes and makes the other run. So, you know, in the meantime, they do have eye degeneration of what's happening with them. So I think that this is a very important bill. It's not political to me. I'm not there to say, yeah, we need to intrude on ophthalmologists' ability to what they're doing. They provide a very special field of specialists. All I'm asking is to let the optometrists that visit my area, the rural communities, the bush communities, the privilege and to give full treatment to the patients they have out there. And I'm not, you know, and I would like to ask when they get on board the ophthalmologists whose eyes are more important, the people from the bush and the rural or people from the urban. And I know that I have my friend behind me, and I'm glad that he was in Juneau when he had his eye problems, that if he was someplace else, he may not have any sight left at all. Because if I'm talking about Clinkett boy, he's behind me. Had he been in Hoonah, things may have been even worse. So anyway, it's kind of a plea, and I know the chairman told me she was going to hold the bill, but I'm hoping that you reconsider and move this along, because it is a passionate plea, and it's not, you know, because I lobby it. It's just that I believe in taking care of the eyes of my people.
Thank you, Representative Thomas. Sorry.
That's because I talked to him this week. Huh?
It is my intention to hold the bill, but I'm. I want to hear, because it is different than the one last year, so I want to make sure that we talk about it and discuss the differences from last year. Representative Anderson.
Gardner
than Anderson.
Thank you. I have a question, and I think, like a lot of people, I'm often confused about the difference between optometrists and ophthalmologists. But my understanding is that an ophthalmologist is an MD doctor and an optometrist is not. And part of the reason I'm confused if that's accurate is because you talked about allowing doctors to use their education and training. Are optometrists doctors?
My understanding is that they have the education to provide and give oral pharmaceuticals, prescriptions. They've been trained in that, and we'll let the specialist come up and argue that and present it to you. But through the years that I've seen all the graphs, yes, they've had the proper training to do the prescriptions for certain prescriptions. And if not, then I don't think the other 44 states in the U.S. would have allowed it to happen.
And follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Gardner.
Aside from the issue of whether they have the training or not, I think they're not MD doctors, but we do have nurse practitioners who can do prescriptions, right?
Exactly.
And they're not MD doctors either. And that's kind of my other question about this. If you're in a remote community or one of these little villages that doesn't have an ophthalmologist and you have a problem with your eye that maybe is an eye infection or whatever, can you not go to a nurse practitioner or some other healthcare professional to get antibiotics or whatever is needed?
I guess, Madam Chair, through the Chair, Representative Gardner, my concern, yes, he probably could, but what if they misdiagnose it? And, I think everybody's worried about proper diagnosis on anything, and you can go in there, and I think once, if you know what it is, mm-hmm. they probably could treat it. I've been to, because I live in a rural area, a lot of the times, even in Haines is rural because it's under 7,500, you end up seeing a nurse practitioner versus the doctor if they're not on call, if they're on break or something. You talk about keeping employees and teachers, try to keep a doctor in a rural area. And so you do go in and see them, and they'll give you a prescription. You know, it's totally amazing. But, and I have no problem with that because most of the time when I go to the doctor, I'm hurting. I got high tolerance for pain, but sometimes I got to go in there. And they do, and so I'm happy they can, but I just believe that if an optometrist is there and they see a problem, they can fix it, help fix it, give the right prescription rather than delay, because I think that eye care, mm-hmm. if you mistreat it, misdiagnose it, I'm a physician assistant and I do it wrong. You put something in somebody's eyes, they've taken it in their body and it's wrong. You know, I'd feel sad for them.
What I'd like to do is get some of the specialists up here and let them testify. If can you wait with your question or at
sure,
least
and
ask,
I'll ask the next.
Okay, yeah. Great. Let's do off net first. Carl Rosen, are you online?
Yeah, hi, I'm online.
Carl
Rosen here. I'm the president of the Alaska Eye Physicians and Surgeons. I'm an ophthalmologist in Anchorage, Alaska. Most of you on the committee know me and recognize my voice. My colleague, Griffith Steiner, who's an ophthalmologist, I believe is in the audience and will testify. But I'd be happy to go first if you'd like.
Go right ahead.
Okay. A couple of points, and Representative Gardner brought this up. It is true that ophthalmologists are surgical subspecialists. They are the providers who do go to medical school. You go to college for 4 years. You then apply, and it's a rigorous application to medical school. There's approximately 130 medical schools. About 1 in 200 people who apply get accepted. You then do 4 years of medical school, and you go through the various systems of physiology, anatomy, and clinical care and treatment. You then graduate, do an internship, which is 1 year in medicine or surgery. I did a medical internship in New York, and then that's a rigorous year, usually 100, 120 hours a week. And then you do a residency. You apply for a residency while you're in medical school, and that is in ophthalmology, a three-year intensive program where you learn to diagnose, treat, and operate regarding eye disease and eye care. And you are thrust into a position where you're typically in a large university or city hospital, and you take care of sick people. You take care of people who have cardiac disease, diabetes, hypertension, renal failure, multi-system disease, so that not only can you prescribe glasses and contact lenses, and all ophthalmologists can do that, but you've also been subject to the most dire and critical illnesses that a patient can present with, and you get comfortable with that. So it's no longer anxiety-provoking. Well, it's always anxiety-provoking, but you know how to deal with it. And the system filters out people who cannot handle it and don't have the wherewithal or the constitution to do that. And furthermore, it filters out people who can't handle the surgical anxiety that comes along. So that's an ophthalmologist. Now, what I did is I did a fellowship on top of the 3 years of residency to further train myself in orbital surgery and neuro-ophthalmology. I hope that answers your question. The issue about the rarity of finding an ophthalmologist in a rural community is yes and no. The native hospital, which is outside the private sector, travels frequently to various native communities and has their own patient population. The Air Force also does that. We at Ophthalmic Associates, the largest ophthalmology practice in the state, have our docs go to Kodiak, Cordova, docs go to Sitka, there are docs in Juneau, Fairbanks. So the community is served well. And again, the native hospital takes care of a lot of the native populations in the more rural areas. So I think that argument doesn't hold as much water as would seem at first light. Thirdly, it is true that nurse practitioners have the ability to prescribe medications, but that is what they are trained to do. They are trained specifically to be the first line, treat with antibiotics. They become familiar with the side effects, the interactions, the pharmacology. Optometry, particularly anyone beyond the 5 years ago, did not have the intensive training that is necessary to understand the pharmacokinetics, the interactions. I mean, I still, and my colleagues still, rely on infectious disease, nephrology, various other specialties to help us understand oncology. What happens when you take cyclophosphamide, Imuran, prednisone, lisinopril, and Tamoptic, you know, which is a glaucoma medication? Because this whole milieu, this soup of medications, you know, in a single dosage may affect, it has been well studied, the FDA has approved it, but when you have multiple medications, all bets are off, and that's why I frequently consult, you know, the other surgical, or the other medical specialties or the other surgical specialties. And that is the other advantage of an ophthalmologist versus an optometrist, because optometry does not have hospital-based privileges, does not interact with the medical community on a daily basis. What else can I say? This bill does not differentiate treating an infant versus a 99-year-old. I find that there's a danger in just allowing this to go forward. We've seen this bill in the past. We've consistently been able to thwart this expansion bill. And not only myself representing ophthalmology, but the legislature and the medical community. Now, if you read the bill, it's under the jurisdiction of the optometric community, which is outside the purview of the medical board and the medical community. And I think that's also a problem, and I think that's also dangerous. What else? Certainly, if a patient has a problem, you can get on the phone and you can reach an ophthalmologist at any time. And that's why we do take call for the people of Alaska as a courtesy to the people of the state. And I'm available 24/7. That's the way I take care of my orbits and the trauma that I take care of. So I think that argument is taken care of. Also, the fact that this bill has, some states do have this bill, but if you look at the overall number of optometrists who use it, it's very small. Very small. Let's say there's 100 optometrists in New Mexico who have this privilege. Roughly 10 to 15 will actually use medications on a consistent basis to be considered familiar with medications. So the vast majority don't have the numbers. And in medical school and in residency training, you're only allowed to graduate if you can prove that you have the wherewithal, the capability to do this procedure or to understand this disease. That's how medical school training, and optometric training will not have that because now they're outside of school and they're relying on the optometric board to give them a go or no go on this. So I think that's also a problem. In any case, I oppose this bill, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. We do have a question. Representative Anderson has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, Dr. Rosen.
Howdy. A
couple quick questions. One, you stated that you had 4 years of college, then 1 year.
4 years. I went to Amherst College in Massachusetts. I graduated with honors. I then went on to medical school. I went to Harvard and Boston University School of Medicine. I did an MD, MA. I did graduate work in immunology. I then went on to an internship at Albert Einstein College of Medicine for a year of 100 to 120 hours a week, which was 1 year that I would not want to do again. I then did my residency of 3 years of ophthalmology after that at Albert Einstein, and then I did a year of fellowship. So essentially, I was training for 14 years.
Okay, thank you. And then that was 1 year for fellowship was what my question was. Then the second question is, I just real quick for the record, so members of the committee understand your perspective, to grant optometrists the expansion of prescriptive rights, you're testifying to that I hear you could be harmful. Maybe, maybe not. It depends. It's like a pilot. They better make sure that they're practicing this and they're dispensing
right
on a regular basis so they can harm. But my question is, but to not let them, the sponsor stated, who I respect very much, and he used Bob in the audience. God, thank God Bob was able to come, Lozier was able to come to Juneau because he could have been harmed but for there being an ophthalmologist in Juneau if he would have stayed where he was at. That point being made, if the bill isn't passed, do you think there will be a conflagration or a big forest fire? That's the wrong term, but a big...
I understand.
You know, of harm done. It doesn't sound like there's been any harm.
No. As long as you're able to communicate the clinical symptoms and describe the ophthalmic condition to an ophthalmologist or even the emergency room, which you can transfer to the ophthalmologist, and this has happened many, many times. Every time I'm on call, essentially, it happens. We're able to intervene and appropriately manage and assess the patient and then prescribe whatever medication, if any, is necessary. I have there is no public outcry for this, and I have not heard or know of a problem where an optometrist has had a dire condition and has not been able to contact an ophthalmologist when needed. I just don't know of one.
Thank you.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a real quick question, just curiosity. Is telemedicine playing a part in this anymore?
No, Representative Sisson, that's a very good question. I was going to talk about that. I am very much tied into telemedicine. It's not only something I think is extremely important, but it's been a hobby of mine and an avocation for the past 7 years. I'm on the board with Jerome Liss and Richard Neubauer, Robert Hall, also from the Afghan program, and we are looking into telemedicine. I have done telemedicine with First Class from Dutch Harbor, and it does work. And what we are trying to do now is get more of the community, more of the medical community online to accept this, because it's hard to put down the paper and pencil for a database and a PC tablet. But we believe, and so does the Bush administration, that this must happen, and there is a lot of enthusiasm being generated actually recently. So in not the near and too distant future, really, I think this is going to happen. But I have done it. I've done approximately 28 consults using that. And I took care of herpes zoster, herpes simplex, basal cell of the lower lid, and it was effectively treated.
Okay, thank you. We need to move on. Thank you, Dr. Rosen.
Thank you.
How are we going to get this next one wrong? Dr. Sinati? Probably killing the name.
No.
Is there Dr. Sinati online at C-I-N-O-T-T-I?
Yes, I am.
Pronounce it correctly.
Dr. Sinati.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead and tell us who you represent and give us your testimony.
Thank you very much. I'm from the American Academy of Ophthalmology. I'm in New Jersey, and I'm on the State Affairs Committee. We monitor these types of bills for all over the country, and we look at the ramifications and how they are progressing. We have expertise in all of these type of legislative efforts. I was here basically to back up and discuss anything that happens nationally or any testimony that was given nationally. We have nationwide, we have very concerned about this bill because it is by far the most expansive of any bill that we've seen in a long time because of the vague language in the bill. It keeps talking about the use of pharmaceutical agents, but it doesn't specifically say oral pharmaceutical agents. That would lead one to believe that injectable medications could be used, injections into the eye could be used. And that is very troublesome to us. We are also concerned about the use of off-label medications. As was discussed before, the treatments for ophthalmic disorders are becoming very complex. Uveitis is an inflammation of the inside of the eye, and the treatments are going towards the use of anti-cancer medications, which can be very dangerous in the wrong hands. Methotrexate is an anti-cancer drug, which is now commonly used in uveitis. And just recently, there have been reported two deaths in England where it was used for arthritis, and the patients developed pneumonitis, which is an inflammation and then an infection in the lungs. And certainly, we don't believe that the optometrists have the expertise or the knowledge to recognize the complications of use of these medications, nor the ability to treat them properly. As has been said, it's often mentioned that there is not enough ophthalmologists around to take care of the patients, but in reality there are, because when a patient goes to an emergency room in an area, they usually have an arrangement with an ophthalmologist on call who can determine what is the proper treatment. I think that the representative who proposed this bill even said that when he saw the physician assistant called the MD to get authorization for his treatment and prescribe the medication. This bill has no oversight by physicians or optometrists. There would be no phone call to an ophthalmologist to see if the medication or the diagnosis is indeed correct. So it makes it a very, very expansive bill, a very dangerous bill, no oversight. There's no input from the medical board. All the oversight is through the optometric board. The education is very suspect, how they're going to keep up their knowledge of medications is extremely important. And in general, it's a very, very dangerous bill, and we around the rest of the country are extremely worried of these types of bills. So I thank you, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Seaton has a question for you.
Yeah, question on page 1, lines 9 through 11 of the bill, where it's a pharmaceutical agent is prescribed and used for the treatment of ocular disease or conditions, ocular and endexal or conditions, or emergency anaphylaxis. Is that not tight enough? Is that what your testimony is?
Well, think about it this way. As I said, many of the treatments are progressing. Right now we have diseases, diabetic retinopathy, which we notice that there is a swelling in the macula, which is the center of the vision in the eye. Now, many of the treatments are going to give direct injections inside the eye to treat this diabetic maculopathy. This bill, since it does not stipulate oral medications, that means any medication to use to treat the eye could be injected inside the eye. Treatment for AIDS, patients with AIDS-related ophthalmic disorders get injections into the eyes. They also have implants of antiviral agents that are injected into the eyes. This would also be available to an optometrist for use. So it's not tight at all because it says pharmaceutical agent. It does not say oral medication, oral pharmaceutical agent. It says all pharmaceutical agents, and I think that's one of the big problems.
Okay, a follow-up, Representative Seaton.
So if this was tightened up to, say, oral pharmaceutical agent, that would be much tighter in your opinion then?
Well, I think that it would be tighter in that it would eliminate the problems with the injectable medications. But you still need to address the off-label use of medications. I think that if you're going to do a bill, what you want to look at is what is necessary for the optometrist to really treat in the rural areas. If the representative's concern is that they need to use antibiotics, then the bill should specifically say what antibiotics that they should use. An ophthalmologist in practice does not, in general, use controlled substances. I've been a director of ocular trauma in a major hospital for 22 years, where we do a lot of trauma. I have not written a prescription for a controlled substance or a narcotic in at least 3 years. So what is the point of giving the optometrist the right to prescribe narcotics? So there's many things that need to be tightened up if that is what your intent is. If there's a need for them to use antibiotics and there are certain antibiotics, then it should be spelled out in which antibiotics they should be allowed to use.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's go on to Dr. Boyd Walker. Are you online?
I am. Okay. I am. I guess I've been unmuted, so I can speak with you now.
Okay, thank you.
I guess I would like to address a couple of remarks that have been made by Dr. Rosen and the previous speaker.
Can you
and
first,
that relates to a number of complications that they describe could result from injection of drugs into the eye. I think it needs
Dr.
to be made
Walker?
Clear that optometric treatment doesn't generally involve entering the eye to perform treatment, and I believe that it is up to the individual practitioner to make the decision as to whether something is within their scope of practice and without. An example of that would be that a family practice doctor may well be capable of delivering a baby, but an obstetrician would think that maybe he would not do quite as good a job of it. And I believe that that's the same situation that we have here, is that the ophthalmologist's level of training is certainly higher than that of an optometrist, and I'm not here to argue that point. I highly respect those individuals and what they do, and actually work closely with them. But in routine practice, there are times when individual optometrists need to have the ability to prescribe oral medications, and occasionally even injecting chalazion or doing some superficial injections may well be indicated, especially in rural areas of Alaska. So I would certainly not be in agreement with them that these are as likely to occur as they make you think. I recall back in the 70s when optometrists were not allowed to use any medications whatever, not for the purpose of diagnosing eye disease nor for the purpose of treating eye disease. And ophthalmology said, gosh, people die from eye drops that dilate your eyes. Well, I believe today that after 15 years of experience that even our ophthalmology colleagues would agree that optometry has served a great function in terms of diagnosing eye disease that they would not have been able to find had diagnostic pharmaceuticals been allowed to optometry. Dr. Rosen alluded to the fact that even in states like New Mexico that have these drugs, not everyone uses them. I certainly believe that proves that optometrists are judicious in their use of these drugs. They only use them when they're necessary. They probably do refer a lot of these patients who need these drugs to ophthalmologists if that's readily available. But in rural Alaska, there certainly are cases where individuals might need immediate treatment and are certainly unable to get it as a result of not having this ability. The issue of education of optometry seems to be at the forefront here, and I believe each of you has a packet which outlines the education of an optometrist. Nowhere near that of an ophthalmologist, but comparable to that of a family practice physician or of a dentist, and certainly in most cases above that of a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant. So a lot of these individuals using these medications and doing a good job with them are faced with those same risks that medications present, and they make judgments about their appropriateness and use them judiciously and to the benefit of their patients. So I believe that optometrists do have the education and the credentials to use these medications. I think that they will be careful in using them to the best interest of their patients. I believe that rural Alaskans will really benefit from this in terms of not having to wait for treatment or travel and lose time so that they can travel to a larger center where an ophthalmologist may be available. And in general, I would urge you to support this bill as being beneficial to the public in Alaska.
Dr. Walker?
Yes, ma'am.
We don't know where you're from or your title.
I'm sorry. I'm an optometrist, and I practice in Homer.
Okay, thank you. Any questions by the I have a question. Dr. Rosen told us all kinds of credentials that he had, and I neglected to ask him what's the bottom line. I mean, what's the least amount that you could training you could go to and still be called an ophthalmologist? And so I will find that out from someone. Tell me, this list that we have in front of us, it's for 4 years. Does every optometrist have to go that full 4 years to be called an optometrist?
That's correct. Presently, one would have to go through 4 years of undergraduate work or pre-optometry, pre-medicine, whichever course one would choose, and then an additional 4 years of postgraduate training in optometry school. Many of our doctors have actually subsequently had some sort of an internship or residency, although that is not all that common.
Okay, so you have 4 years of regular college and then another 4 years of optometry school.
That is correct.
And Madam Chair, it's 4 and 9 for the physician. 4 years of undergrad, applied to medical school, and then 9 years. Dr. Rosen went 10.
Representative Anderson, did you want to make a comment?
Well, that's the answer to your question. Yeah. Not a comment, an answer.
Yeah. Madam Chair. Representative Sisson.
Thank you so very much, Madam Chair. My question of Dr. Walker, my question would be, it's been how many years now? I think this is the seventh year, perhaps, that we've had essentially this piece of legislation on committees that I was a member of. And so I'm wondering, now, over and over and over and over again, we've heard this change of scope of practice legislation, and there's been every time some real concern by the medical community about this, and I'm wondering what this legislation does in terms of, since the concern has been the training that went with the increase of scope of practice, you mentioned that some optometrists do internships. That sounds to me as if that might be the difference between, or one of the pieces between, the medical community concerns and what's missing in terms of the training. Is there some way that the optometrists could compromise or think of some ways to increase their education so that these concerns by the medical community can be solved? And I don't hear that in this bill, and if I'm wrong, please tell me. And just tell me why there isn't more, because we're going over this over and over again, and I'm wondering if we couldn't maybe move this along a little bit somehow.
Well, I guess I could only respond to that by saying that optometric education already trains the individuals to use these medications. So as far as your indication is that the medical community wishes us to have some additional training, I perceive that they feel that possibly we're untrainable. It doesn't appear that it's the optometric community that is lacking in compromise on this. It appears to me to be the ophthalmology community, and I don't even categorize that as being the medical community. I believe a moment ago Representative Anderson referred to the fact that the physicians had 13 years of training, and certainly the eye physicians do, the ophthalmologists do. Family practice physicians do not have 13 years of training, and the training that an optometrist has is comparable to that of a dentist or a family practice doc in terms of the number of years of professional school that they have. Certainly, optometric statute today presently requires that optometrists have continuing medical education, and that's regulated by the state. And for those optometrists who utilize pharmaceutical agents, they have to have specific retraining on an annual basis, or on a recertification basis. So I guess it's a biannual basis now, to renew their license to show that they've actually stayed current with medications. As we all recognize by simply watching the TV, there's new medications every day on television, and some of them I haven't even heard of. And so we all have to be cognizant of the changes that are occurring and go through a relearning process, and we're no different than the ophthalmologists in that respect, that we need to have that recurrent training. And it is there, and it's already in regulation.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Walker. There's another committee that's going to meet in this room at 5:30, so we have to be out of here at 5:30. So I'd like to get Mike Bennett. Is there anybody in the room here that came specifically for this? And would, why don't you come forward? Because you might not be able, if you came from out of town, is what my concern.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I'm going to kind of.
I have a quick question for Dr. Walker.
Go ahead.
And that is
Representative
Gardner.
I don't
know why. Okay. It's relating to the years of training, and of course my question would be how much of it is specifically pharmaceuticals. But my real question here is, a naturopath doctor, calls himself doctor also, has 8 years of training as well. Do we think that they should have prescriptive rights?
That's a fight for that.
Is that your question of me?
Yes, uh-huh.
Well, quite frankly, I know nothing about the training of a naturopath, and I certainly couldn't speak to that. I feel that every professional who is asking to use medications should be, or to perform procedures should be, willing to put out their their curriculum of training so that you can analyze it, and you are the body that's judged, or they're judging whether the individuals should or should not perform that procedure. The the physicians or those who have an MD behind their name, once they've received their training and have their degree and their board exams behind them, really have no one to answer to other than the medical board. Other practitioners, all other practitioners, in fact, are what we would call limited license practitioners, and those individuals must come to you, the legislature, to develop regulation to delineate their scope of practice. And that's what this is all about, and that's why the naturopaths come to you to ask you what they can do, and the podiatrist will do the same, and I'm sure you have a litany of other professionals who have to come to you and get you to put into regulation what they may do.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, Griff Steiner.
That's right.
Okay. Griff, tell us your credentials and then give us your testimony.
Yeah, I'm Griff Steiner, MD. I'm an ophthalmologist. I represent the ophthalmologists in Alaska, and I also like to believe the patient care in Alaska. As Dr. Rosen said, you know, my training is 13 years, 4 years of college, and I went to Stanford. I was a West High graduate. I'm also a fourth-generation Alaskan. But I'm a West High graduate, 4 years at Stanford University, 4 years of medical school, 1 year of medicine, internal medicine internship, pure internal medicine for a year, 3 years of ophthalmology, and 1 year of fellowship in specializing in glaucoma and corneal surgery training. I'd like to, with all due respect to Boyd Walker and the profession of optometry, which I greatly respect, and a great number of them practice their specialty with great skill, I have to refute a number of his assertions. He compares the training of optometrists to family medical physicians. Family medical physicians went to medical school, and during that entire time, they were using medications on patients under the supervision of other physicians the entire time they're in that training. Dentists, he compares himself to dentists, during their training, the entire time they are injecting patients, giving them pain medications, oral antibiotics under supervision. Nurse practitioners, the same thing, under supervision. They are throughout their entire training giving medications, watching the side effects, watching the complications. At no time during an optometrist training are they prescribing medications under any supervision or prescribing medications at all. There is also no necessity for this bill from the standpoint that the most likely thing for them to prescribe would be oral antibiotics or oral pain medications. As one of the other doctors, the doctor from New Jersey, mentioned, for years he never prescribed those, and he's the head of trauma in a major hospital. I'm the only corneal specialist in the state of Alaska as a private practitioner, and I have never had to inject a Chalazion, as he recommends. I have very rarely had to prescribe oral antibiotics, and the only times I've ever had to prescribe oral antibiotics is when the patient had a very dire infection, the kind that could kill them, the thing that would have to be referred. If an optometrist saw lid swelling and treated with an oral antibiotics, and it was instead a diabetic infection in the sinuses, that patient would die in a matter of days. It cannot be overstated that optometrists have no practical training in prescribing medications other than eye drops. During their training, they do not prescribe oral antibiotics or pain medications to patients in the hospital. They're not responsible for any patients in the hospital during their entire training. The fact that he would suggest that they have equivalent training to dentists or nurse practitioners or especially family physicians is manifestly false and dangerous. I also agree with the doctor from New Jersey who says that this is a dangerous bill from its vagueness. It allows them a huge latitude in prescribing medications, which is dangerous. In my personal opinion, not only is this bill very dangerous, but it appears to me to be a stepping stone from experience from other states. This bill establishes a sort of precedent that they have certain skills. If this bill was to pass, they would have precedent to then apply to the Drug Enforcement Agency federally to be allowed to prescribe anything up to and including cocaine, psilocybin, drugs that are just way outside their purview. My feeling is that this bill is dangerous on its face and probably a stepping stone to be allowed to do surgical things, which they are also not trained for. To simplify this again and restate what I just said, keeping it to the way the bill is written, they're asking to prescribe things that they have never done in training. Reading is, if we were to accept they read as much pharmacology as we did, which is not true. We read much more pharmacology in much more depth. If we were to believe that they even read the same amount we did, that would not in any way qualify them to prescribe medications to anybody. We read much more in depth, and we prescribed these medications for years under the supervision of physicians in the hospital under dire circumstances. We saw patients die. We saw patients have complications. We saw patients have interactions with other medications. There is no comparison, and not only is there no comparison, but they have actually no clinical experience in prescribing medications, which nurse practitioners do, dentists do, family physicians do. The pain medications are only necessary for me. I only rarely prescribe them, and it's for post-operative situations, which optometrists cannot operate. The only way they're associated with operations is by doing the post-operative care for an itinerant physician that flies up from out of state, does a surgery, leaves the patient in the care of the optometrist. They are not trained to do this either. If we allow them to do these prescriptions, they will be prescribing medications for patients they're not trained to take care of in the first place, and they're especially not allowed to prescribe the medications to those patients. And there'll be no supervision as this itinerant physician flies immediately back out of Seattle. And unfortunately, because of the financial arrangement, they're reluctant, the optometrists, the local optometrists, are reluctant to call us for questions because they're embarrassed because they know their relationship with this outside physician. And we've seen many complications from this. The itinerant physician himself has said that he doesn't feel qualified to treat these medical patients. So he does not take referrals. As an MD, he does not take referrals from his optometric network. And the optometrists are too embarrassed or reluctant to refer to us because of the arrangement with the itinerant physician, which is, albeit not illegal, it allows for a $200 to $400 per eye payment if they refer to the itinerant physician. They get no money if they refer to us. And so they've got a strong relationship with an MD. The only MD that they're strongly associated with feels unqualified to treat patients and then refers them back to the optometrist, who then refer back and forth between optometry. We've seen patients admitted to hospitals treated by optometrists for medications that they're not licensed to prescribe. I don't think I can overstate this enough that, and going back more to the focus of this bill, that they are simply not trained at all clinically to prescribe medications.
Thank you very much. And we're going to have to close testimony and end our, thank you so much for coming, and I really appreciate it. And
thank you.
And I'm sorry that there's other people here that we just don't have time because there's another committee meeting. I will continue testimony on this bill. We're full, our schedule is full until not this week, but the next Thursday. So next Thursday, we will continue testimony on this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned.